Welcome to Spokane Public Radio Talks, Our Water, Our Future, which was recorded at Spokane City Council Chambers. Our thanks to forum partner City Cable 5 and our panelists. The event donors are National Endowment for the Arts, as well as Sayre, Sayre & Fossum, attorneys at law, emphasizing senior citizen law, disability, long-term care benefits, and estate planning at 325-7330. More information about the forum and a resource list is online at SpokanePublicRadio.org.
And welcome to Spokane Talks, Our Water, Our Future. In the next 2 hours, we're going to take a look at a number of different issues facing our region when it comes to water quality and water quantity. Concept is to provide the general public, including our listening audience, when this airs, a better idea of the challenges we face. We would like to thank our event donors, Sayre and Fossum, attorneys at law, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and also the partner in our broadcast, City Cable 5. I want to run down brief bios of the panelists. Guy Gregory, the Technical Unit Supervisor and Senior Hydrologist for the Washington Department of Ecology Resources Program here in Spokane. Rachel Osborne, Public Interest Lawyer assisting citizens and NGOs on water sustainability and nonprofit organizational matters. She serves as Senior Policy Advisor to the Center for Environmental Law and Policy, and is the Spokane River Project Coordinator for the Upper Sierra Club, Upper Columbia River Group. We've got Councilman John Snyder, who is serving his second term as Councilman for District 2. He is a founder and former owner of the award-winning Out There Monthly magazine as well, and has worked on a lot of outdoor issues. Rick Romero is the Utility Division Director for the City of Spokane and manages budgets totaling more than $250 million a year. Rob Lindsay, the Water Resources Manager for Spokane County Utilities Division, who's a registered geologist with the state of Washington, and also for the state of Idaho. Welcome. Thanks so much for helping us with this event. This year has been one of the driest on record in the Inland Northwest. We were talking about this behind the scenes back there, and Guy may have some interesting information to add to this, but since a year ago, October of 2014, the weather station at Spokane International Airport has received 12.5 inches of precipitation in the form of rain. The normal amount would be 16 inches. And statewide, the winter snowpack this year, only 22% of normal as of April the 1st. That's from the Natural Resources Conservation Service. The last time the state was anywhere close to those levels was back in 2005, when it was at 33% of normal. We want to start off talking about drought, but we want to also move into areas dealing with contaminants that may threaten our aquifer and also the Spokane River and other waterways in our area. The impact, of course, of the drought is being felt on community water supplies, river flows, power generation, and fish populations, just to name a few. And global climate change could mean this may be the new normal for our region. We'll have to see how this plays out. We want to talk first about what steps we need to take to better prepare for this. Let's start with, on a municipal scale, let's start with Rick Romero. What is being done or has been done this summer by the city to more or less encourage less water use?
Okay, well, thank you, Steve, and thank you all for being here tonight. As Steve said, I'm the utilities director for the city of Spokane, and with that job comes two paramount responsibilities. One is to look out for our citizens' natural resources. The other is to try to also look out for our citizens' wallets. And conservation really is one of the key elements that I think lets us try to reconcile those two issues in a very nice way. Obviously, this year has been an extreme drought year. We've seen some impacts in river flows. It's been a challenge across the state and the country. The city has made, I think, what I kind of call a three-pronged effort to try to step up our conservation efforts. We try to use a stick, we try to use a carrot, and we try to use education. And on the stick side, really the rate structure is a big part of that, and some may argue that it ought to be less or it ought to be more progressive in its tiered structure. But we do have a tiered water rate structure. The upper tiers of our water rates are about four times the rate they are at the lowest tiers. And if you look at the purveyors across our region here, I feel like the city's really probably got the most progressive tiered structure. The carrot is actually something that council members Waldrop and Snyder helped us work on here this past year. And that's the concern of trying to recognize water use on our wastewater rates. And so we implemented in 2014 a credit program for the lowest 20% of our water users with a credit back of $60 a year on the wastewater bill. So that's been something that our citizens have been pretty happy about. And then I think the last piece is just stepping up our educational efforts. The council recently took action to do an EBO in our budget to increase the number of FTE resources that we're dedicating to those educational programs. And then I think last but not least, we're trying to work closely with our parks. Our park system is one of the highest water users in the city. And we just entered into an agreement with our Parks Department to utilize their property for a number of utility projects. That's going to generate dollars back to parks that they can invest in irrigation improvements and other enhancements that should make a big difference there as well.
Okay. And I want to get a read from John then. Can we revisit this tiered rate structure? Because that was something that obviously Mayor Verner had instituted one type of plan, and then Mayor Condon came in and it was changed. And that was pretty controversial. And the question to John is specifically, do we need to revisit that again? And if we continue to see these kind of weather patterns like this or drought conditions, do we need to look seriously at maybe charging more money for the highest water users?
Well, nothing helps conservation like higher water rates. Let's just be honest about that. We tried to make a change to the water rate structure. We didn't implement it well. We ended up reversing it. But the kind of dirty little secret about the city budget is that we're utterly dependent on utility taxes that come from water revenue, which creates this kind of contradiction. If everybody wanted to all of a sudden conserve tomorrow and you used half as much water, it would blow a massive bazooka-sized hole in our budget because we have the highest allowable water utility tax, which is 20%. And we don't have a B&O tax, which some other cities use to balance out the amount of revenue so they're not so dependent on utility tax. So that makes it kind of hard for us. We know we need to conserve. Rick is absolutely right. And actually, Rick has been great to work with as I campaigned for several years to get a 3-year rate ordinance through. Because when we make changes suddenly to rates, it can be very uncomfortable and hard for folks. If we can gradually change those things over, like, say, 3 years, then we get a lot more ability to kind of have an impact on rates without it being so difficult for folks. For example, I kind of think that it's been my assertion that we have sort of subsidized kind of larger water users and higher volume users, and mm-hmm. people that live in multifamily and situations like apartment buildings are paying a lot more, in my mind, for wastewater and water utility than maybe they need to be. So I worked with Rick and other council members to kind of make some subtle changes in the rate structure to point that in another direction. And I think that's worked pretty well. We may want to look at doing more of that. But it's very tricky. Because we need so much of that utility tax revenue, we have to figure out ways that we can also conserve and not all of a sudden blow big holes in our budget.
And I might direct this to Rachel, too, because if I can get a read from you, and you probably know, what kind of things have they been doing, for example, in more drought areas like California regarding this? Is it just rates, or what other kind of mandates have they had to rely on?
Well, rate structures are a big part of it. It is the most effective way to get people to conserve. There's also been the mandate in California from the governor to requiring conservation, which is unique and has actually resulted in quite a response from municipalities in that state. So, but I would point out that there are a lot of things that could be done here in Spokane. One problem we have is we have leakage, water system leakage, reported in the water system plan of 18% of the water that's pumped is being lost in the system. Mm-hmm. And there's a state law that says that number should be no larger than 10%, and it's been in place for maybe 12 or 13 years now. So there's a lot to be done there, and then education is key. We ran a education program this summer called H2Know, and partnered with the city, and the city called for large reductions in water use by citizens. Haven't heard yet how we did, but
is there a way to monitor that? I mean, would it just be to look at, see general water use? Is that the way we would probably check
the city
that
monitors its pumping?
Yeah. So,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe let's talk for a moment then about the statewide impact, and maybe we could even look more focused on the aquifer itself. But Guy, do you want to talk a little bit about maybe the monitoring procedures for looking at the aquifer, and have we been able to determine if there's been any kind of impact of this drought specifically in the aquifer? Because and I wanted to just add, because when you did the H2Know campaign, when we talked to John, your husband, about Rachel, your husband, about the river flows, we were talking a lot about how low the river flows were and how they were being recharged by the aquifer. I'm just assuming that means the aquifer levels would have been going down too. Have we been able to determine that?
Steve, yeah, there's a couple of wells in the aquifer area that are monitored and published daily on the internet. In general, the aquifer's pretty healthy. It got a pretty good dose of recharge. It's not at levels approaching late 90s low levels, mm-hmm. but we haven't picked up our data that doesn't boot up to the internet well. Some of the preliminary information indicates that because of the higher flows than normal coming out of the Avista Post Falls Dam, that our aquifer looks pretty good in the valley. It is actually a little higher than we would expect it otherwise. Absolutely the very most important bellwether of aquifer health here is the river. We will dry up the river long before we see a presence in the aquifer. And it's very important for folks to know that their water use comes right out of the river. So that's the key measure, and that's we've said that in 2007, and it's continuing to be more obvious with every year that goes by.
And I was going to just compare our own aquifer to these other nearby aquifers. The audience may not be aware, this Grand Ronde aquifer in Pullman has been declining by several inches a year. A new report this week came out from USGS showed bad news for the Columbia Plateau aquifer. The data indicated 72% of the wells in the last 40 years have been declining there with an average loss of 2 feet per year. So I was just going to ask, maybe direct this at Rachel and or you, Guy, do have these kind of aquifers that we're monitoring, do we know, would they be replenished in wet years, or what's the answer to
this? Well, the answer to that is they're not really replenished in wet years. Most of that water in the Columbia Plateau aquifer systems, of which Pullman is a part, mm-hmm. Most of that groundwater is old water. The Central Basin aquifers is, you know, intensive irrigation, and we're working to bring surface water to the Odessa aquifer, for example. Spending many millions of dollars to do that because it's the rate at which they're pumping that is simply not sustainable. In Pullman, Moscow, I'm an ex officio member of the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee, and they've been working for years, almost 30 years now, to decrease their demand on the aquifer with some success. They currently use, according to USGS estimates, 80 gallons per person per day in Pullman and Moscow. Mm-hmm. We here in Spokane use 185 gallons per person per day on that 2010 study. That's the 95th percentile nationwide. Mm-hmm. So we have plenty of room to kind of, you know, fix a few leaks and take some pressure off our aquifer and our river.
Rachel, regarding those other aquifers, and I know that you've done a lot of public work on this, do you want to weigh in at all about what could be done maybe to protect these out, not the Spokane, but the outlying aquifers? I mean, besides trying to do conservation methods? Or?
Well, the USGS study that came out this week is very bad news because it shows decline throughout the basin, which extends into Oregon and Idaho. And there is virtually no recharge to these aquifers, especially the deep ones, the Grand Ronde and so forth. So in the future, I mean, decisions have been made now in our generation to allocate this water, and it will not be available to future generations. So there are, I think, some significant policy and even moral dimensions
okay.
to that kind of question. Recently, Washington State University built a golf course, and they have a declining aquifer there. Yes, the municipalities and the universities are doing better, but meanwhile, WSU is, you know, expending 50 million gallons per year on a golf course down there that really wasn't necessary. It was mm-hmm. an amenity for the university. So we're still not to the place yet where we're using water wisely.
Okay. I have a few little factoids I wanted to throw in just to liven up the discussion here. On a global scale, fresh water makes up only 2.5% of all the water on Earth. Of that, 95% is fixed in glaciers and ice caps are found deep underground. The remaining 2.5% falls onto the land as rain, of which only about 24% enters rivers and streams and is accessible as surface water. And then just to show you how important water is, a large portion of that precipitation falls in very remote areas, leaving only about 10% of the total continental precipitation input is easily available for human use. So just to highlight the importance of water in our region. Let's talk for a moment about the waterways, and I'm thinking the Little Spokane River, a good example of a waterway that suffers every year as the summer progresses. As the year progresses, ecology issues the junior water rights folks orders to not use the water for their own irrigation purposes. So I know this in-stream flow rule has been a pretty big deal, and Guy, you've been working on that. Can you explain, I mean, the progress of this and what is these in-stream flows, what are they?
Well, an in-stream flow rule is a flow in the river set by rule at which the river cannot be impaired. So in that case, it works kind of like a water right granted to the public for those in-stream values.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, we established an in-stream flow rule in the Little Spokane drainage. And in this spring, our in-stream flow rule for the main stem Spokane and the aquifer area was established. The low flow there is 850 cubic feet per second during the summer, measured down in the gauge just below the falls here. And so as we move forward, any new water rights will have to not impair that flow. And we believe that as shown by this summer, for example, quite clearly, new water rights will not be, there's no new water available in the Spokane drainage.
And you said the cutoff was 850?
Yes.
When did we reach that this year?
This year, the flow in the river is highly dependent upon releases by a vista out of Post Falls Dam. And it was mid-July when they shut in Post Falls at 600 cubic feet per second, and then they later, very briefly after that, lowered it to 500 CFS, which results in a flow downtown of 700 CFS once you factor in water use.
Mm-hmm.
We used about 250 CFS cubic feet per second out of the river here in the summertime. It was one of the hottest summers on record, and people pumped like crazy. So that you can actually see it in the gauge if you know what you're looking
for. Yeah, that's
for.
Part of the problem is when we get into these hot summer months, people, you know, they may be under a mandate not to use it, but people need water even more for whatever purposes they're using it for.
Well, Steve, we use about between 7 and 10 times more water in the summertime than we do in the winter. So all that water that we use is for outdoor irrigation. That's what we use it for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a trade-off. You know, should we use it for irrigation or should we use it for river?
Okay. I want to talk about this whole water rights issue. And Rachel, you've been keeping good tabs on the history of this. So it's kind of a confusing situation. But could you talk about the state of Washington has what it's a moratorium on water rights or what exactly is happening here?
Well, I don't know if moratorium is the right word. We allocate water out of the stream or by pumping out of an aquifer pursuant to permits or licenses that are issued by the Department of Ecology. And in many places around the state, we've issued water rights that are equal or exceed the amount of water that's available. And
mm-hmm.
so when that occurs, obviously the state cannot issue more water rights, and that's what's happened in the Spokane River Basin. there was a moratorium until the in-stream flow rule was established, and I assume that applications have been piling up and that the state will now begin to process them now that they've adopted the in-stream flow rule.
Okay. And wasn't there like a controversy in one of the other communities out in central Washington to do with that? And I can't quite remember what it is.
To do with?
To do with just the fact that they couldn't issue any more of them at all. I'm trying to remember
what
it was.
Well, it's always controversial in a community that you can't get new water rights. And so when that occurs and new users want more water, they need to find new ways to get it. And so at that point, water right is a property right and can be transferred. And what you see, for example, you're probably talking about Kittitas Valley.
That's what it is, yeah.
What you see is that water banks begin to develop and markets for water, and water right trading back and forth goes on.
And that's something that I had spoken with Rob about, to the water bank issue, and you were prepared to kind of explain that a bit?
Certainly, I'll be happy to do that.
Okay.
Feel free to correct me at any time, Rachel, if I stray beyond. Water banks, as Rachel noted earlier, a water right can be traded. That is, it's a marketable item. It's a pertinent to a property, but water rights can be sold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a water bank is basically a mechanism to expedite exchange of water rights in a particular basin. Taking a half step back, Guy mentioned earlier about, you know, the in-stream flow rule in the early 70s being written for the Little Spokane River, okay? So the Little Spokane River has failed to meet those flows on a regular basis. In the 12 years I've been at Spokane County, I think 8 of those years,
mm-hmm.
It's failed to meet that. The state then sends out notices to water right holders that are junior to that rule, telling them to stop using water, okay? Despite that, development has continued to occur in the Little Spokane River Valley in rural areas with what are called permit-exempt domestic wells, okay? They're not exempt from the water right process, but by definition, they're exempt from the permitting process. And, you know, for lack of a better phrase, I'll just call it a free-for-all. I mean, even in a closed basin such as the Little Spokane, you could go in there as part of developing your personal property. You could go and get a well.
Well permit.
A start card to drill a well.
Okay.
So in the case of Kittitas, what was happening, and Rachel, please jump in if I stray too far. Generally what happened is one of the communities there, I believe is the town of Roslyn, ran out of water rights for municipal purposes to serve their town. They went to Ecology, and Ecology said, sorry, the river's already fully allocated. We're not giving you any more water rights.
And this is for municipal, for city water
for,
use.
For municipal purposes.
Right.
Okay. Well, then the city went back, and the first question, their first response was, well, what about all these homes being built up on the hill? Why do they get water?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That raised the question about the use of permit-exempt wells in closed basins. This has been now ruled on and has gone up all the way to the state Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled back in the summer of 2011, I believe it was, that counties have a responsibility for determining the legal availability of water. And it's really important that you understand that there's a difference between legal availability of water and physical availability of water. We're talking about legal right now. So in the case of Kittitas County and now Spokane County, potentially, these water banks are being established. And what they the idea is you go out and you buy a valid and currently valid water right. Okay, I think we've heard that phrase, use it or lose it. You know, there may be water rights out there that people think are valid, but if they haven't used it in a while, it may not be. But you take a large water right, an agricultural water right of a very large quantity, and then you put that into a trust program, and then you break that up into smaller pieces. And then you sell those individual smaller water rights to individuals who want to develop a home.
Okay.
And it's a one for one. So you're taking water out of production here and then doling it back out. So you're on paper, you're not
You're not running out.
You're not increasing the water use in the basin.
Okay.
So Spokane County just recently finished a feasibility study in partnership with Stevens County and Ponderay County to evaluate the possibility of conducting such a water bank in that area.
Okay. Now, I know the city of Spokane holds water rights that aren't being used right now, too, and so this is kind of a similar topic. There's other areas of the county that we know, like West Plains, and the obvious example that most people cite is Medical Lake because they have a declining water table out there, too. And I know there's been talk about this, and John, you and I have had this conversation before, too. Would the city start shipping water to these communities, nearby communities, maybe start with Medical Lake, but start hitting some of these other nearby areas that need water? Will they be pulling water out of our aquifer as the years progress? So I wanted to ask John, start with John on that, because we've talked about that before. And what is the status of this? There was some sort of plan to do this with Medical Lake originally?
Well, we already do this. We sell about 50 million gallons a year wholesale right now.
To Medical Lake?
Well, to various entities outside our borders.
Okay.
Other water districts, emergency intertie agreements, what have you. Medical Lake, we were looking at increasing that figure about fivefold. Council spoke with Rick, and we all kind of came to the conclusion that instead of looking at a one-off agreement with Medical Lake, it's maybe better for us to look at the whole West Plains as a whole, because they're not the only water need out there, and try to figure out how to plan this and do this deliberately. The problem is, if we got to plan for water in the same way we plan for growth and other things and transportation. Otherwise, it's just, if we just grant water and build out infrastructure to wherever somebody wants it, we spread our whole county out in a way that maybe we didn't intend, and increases the cost of service delivery, whether it's law enforcement, firefighting, parks, streets, what have you. And so we need to look at water as being completely connected to our development and our zoning. If we give somebody, you know, too much water and they're able to, like, you know, build another kind of centralized downtown or industrial park that competes with something we have already, it kind of shoots us in the foot. So that's why we need to look at these things holistically.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I mean, at what point do we finally decide that we have a limit where we can't afford to provide these outside communities with water? Do you, Rick or Rachel, want to
And so let me follow up a little bit with John's discussion and comments. I think there's a couple key points with the city water rights, one of which is water is one of those kind of different services for the city, because under the coordinated water system plan, the water districts or water purveyors have kind of defined areas of service that their rights pertain to. And so the city of Spokane's rights aren't solely for the city of Spokane. They're for a broader area that's probably about double the size geographically.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is west and south of the city. And again, the unused water rights are traditionally there for growth. And in the city's case, and I've got to give a little shout out to our citizens on this, the modeling that I've seen from the past typically assumed that as you grow, the water use is going to grow in correlation to that. But one thing that I would say our citizens, I think, have done a pretty good job is, from 20 years ago, our population has grown about 15%. But our water use as a city has actually declined 15%. So the city has absorbed all of that growth and still reduced the water consumption. And mm-hmm. some of that's behavior, some of that is just low flow fixtures and technology. But the bottom line is the trend is going in the right way.
Well, here's an interesting scenario, and you may have heard this summer. There was some quote from William Shatner to do with the California drought, and it was, you know, pretty far-fetched stuff, but saying, why can't we down here in California get water from the Pacific Northwest? I mean, given that we have abundant water in their minds. So, I mean, a long-term kind of look at that. Rachel, do you want to weigh in on that? I mean, is that something that could ever happen? And what would we have in our region to protect us if we want to keep our own water?
Actually, that's one reason adopting in-stream flow rules is important, because it establishes a water right for the river. And once those flows are met, or they're actually not being met, you can demonstrate at that point that water is not available for export out of the basin.
Uh-huh.
I would like to answer that. I think we don't have enough to protect us from that. I mean, we may think that we have laws on the books and mechanisms that prevent that, but we don't know what happens when people really get desperate for water in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, I think, is possible. And we have actually, you know, as Guy described, we've got a great aquifer. You can bottle this water that we're drinking here anywhere and send it around, and it would be welcomed anywhere in the country. It is awesome water. I think that's one of the things we have to think about in the future is how do we make sure that we have, you know, the water that we need protected. One of the ideas I think we need to consider for the city of Spokane is putting some of our water rights in trust so that they are permanently assigned to the river. So there's like we set a floor for how much of the city of Spokane's water rights go into the river.
Okay. Yeah, Rob.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. I'd like to add on a little bit to the notion of extending the water out and looking at collectively at development on the west and south of town. Okay, and I'll speak as much as a citizen and as a hydrogeologist. We have an interesting dichotomy in this community as we have an area of very abundant water directly adjacent to an area of great scarcity. The West Plains is very similar to the, you know, Rachel spoke of the USGS report about the Columbia Plateau. That's Columbia Plateau out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's Columbia Plateau south of town in the Latah Basin. You know, so you don't have to go too far south and you're drilling wells into basalt again. John is absolutely correct that, you know, when people get desperate for water, they'll go to extreme measures. And that means drilling their own wells. And to the extent that if people or developers are feeling as though, you know, the water, you know, municipal water may or may not be available to them, they may feel motivated to go out and develop their own wells.
You mean like kind of guerrilla drilling their own wells?
Well,
like,
you know,
off the grid?
The way our current water system, you know, works is you know, water providers, you know, have a certain amount of time to provide response to developers as to whether or not they can provide water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then and it's defined in what's called the Coordinated Water System Plan that you know that we all play by here. And so, if water is not available in a timely and reasonable manner, then a developer, depending on availability of water rights, can go out and drill their own wells. In the case of areas of scarcity, it's not smart water policy.
Okay.
To develop individual wells for smaller developments, particularly in water scarce areas.
And I had a kind of a follow up question too regarding that. So many folks may not realize, but in the county, the permit that you can get to drill your own well, you only have to be able to prove that you can get 1 gallon of water per minute. Now, I don't know anybody that could live on a gallon of water per minute in their private residence, but that's the requirement right now with the county. So a very easy requirement for someone building a new home, or especially, like you said, easy requirement for developers. But so can we talk for a minute, Rob, what that means for rural areas where people, you know, that live in the county anyway, and maybe they have an adequate water supply right now, but they may be threatened by more and more development in their area if these are the type of lenient standards that are allowed before you can get this well.
Indeed, I get phone calls like that regularly, and this year in particular, as do our water purveyors. Interestingly, that 1 gallon a minute is probably one of the more lenient standards in the state. There are other areas of the state where you don't have to demonstrate even a gallon a minute. Like you, I have a hard time imagining how a person can live on a gallon a minute, but a lot of people do in this community, and a lot of people live on even less water than that, and they truck water, and they keep it on their property, and they live a very water-austere lifestyle. The hazard comes when you get a neighbor and another neighbor, and too many straws into the bucket can exhaust that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are areas that I can think of, you know, particularly north of town, where communities have had to go back to the water purveyors in the area and spend significant amounts of money to have pipes installed out to their areas.
But they can't get those kind of pipes everywhere, can they?
No,
unless
they
they're
can't.
Like in a,
no,
like
no.
an urban growth area
right,
or something?
Right.
Okay.
So, you know, our approach at Spokane County Water Resources and using, you know, funds from the state to develop our, you know, water resources and watershed management plan is information. And, you know, we provide information to our planning departments when, you know, when they're looking at comprehensive plan amendments and so forth. We provide information to landowners or potential property purchasers. They call us. They want to know what's the water situation. Ecology maintains a very robust web page where you can use a map-based tool. And if you're looking to buy a piece of property in a particular area, you can go there and you can click on well logs that have been historically drilled in those areas and look at what the water situation is in those areas.
Can I add something here, though?
Yeah.
I mean, Rob brought it up, and that is that counties have a duty to actually determine whether water is legally available. And in places where in-stream flows are not being met, such as the Little Spokane River Basin, or out on the West Plains where you know water is in decline, water is not available. Physically, there's a problem, but legally, there's also a problem. And under the Supreme Court decision that Rob mentioned, the Kittitas Valley case, counties have a duty to actually determine whether water is available and to deny building permits and subdivision permits mm-hmm. if water is not available. And that's what Spokane County is not doing right now. I mean, education information is good, but the county actually has a legal duty that it's not meeting. And I think there's a crisis building over this. I understand this is why one reason why water banking is you're attempting to establish a water bank, but there's it's a very similar situation to what was occurring in the Kittitas Valley, where Ecology eventually just said no more wells of any kind at all, period. And that day is coming here, where we'll be turning down the county will have to be turning down building permits.
And what would force the county to finally take that action, though? Seriously, I mean, who's going to do that?
In the Kittitas Valley, it was a group of local farmers whose senior water rights were being affected who essentially petitioned Ecology to issue a rule to close the basin. There was also lawsuits by FutureWise and local organizations mm-hmm. that culminated in the Supreme Court decision. So it may take litigation if the county itself doesn't come to understand and act on what its legal duties are.
Okay. Did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that. We're well aware of the law. We have been following this very closely. We've been working in concert with the state of Washington, who's been delegated the authority to manage the waters of the state. Our interpretation of the rule as it's currently written includes specific language for exemptions for domestic use. Admittedly, this particular rule is viewed as one of the most inarticulate of the water resource rules that have been written. It was written in the early 70s. There are apparent contradictions. This rule is open to interpretation. I would remind many of you that natural resource law, if you go and look back historically at the books, it's written very simply. And natural resource law is then implemented in the courts. And it's a very dynamic legal environment. What we thought was standard practice 10 years ago, we're looking back at now and saying, oh no, that's not right. So I would say that Spokane County is well aware of the situation, and we're moving forward positively in establishing a one-for-one water bank scenario to address this situation. Now, if somebody wants to come in and, you know, and push the issue and take us to court, well, I can't affect that, but you know, we're moving forward as you know, conscientiously and effectively, you know, with the courts, and I think we're doing the right thing.
Okay, Guy, did you have something you want to add to that too?
Steve, we're facing these issues statewide, The fact of the matter is the Department of Ecology has been issuing water rights in this state for nearly 100 years. And just we're to the point now to where just because you see it doesn't mean you can have it. It's most of the water you see, at least in the summertime, is spoken for. Somebody else owns it, or it needs to go to some other resource. Now, here in this town and in this region, actually including Idaho, we're working with the tribes, local government, water purveyors, cities, environmental groups. Everybody knows what the end product looks like. We differ on how fast we can get there or how quickly we can get there, but we're all working towards the same goal. And I think that's something we need to remember.
Okay, great. And John, you started to talk about this a little bit, but your concern about providing water outside the city had a lot to do with what they call the urban growth areas, because you were concerned about the infrastructure, I mean, cost of infrastructure, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a shadow city basically built around Spokane of high-density multifamily shopping centers and strip malls that are just right outside our city border. And why do we have that? I mean, part of it is that we haven't had good planning over the last few decades of how we deliver water and where we put growth. The county has really can do whatever it wants with the urban growth area. We don't have an ability to compel the county to keep the urban growth area at a certain point. There's great disagreement about how much we need in the urban growth area to handle future population. I looked at the previous incarnation of one of our water plans, and it projected that we would have 237,000 people in the city of Spokane by 2015. Well, we only have more like 215,000 in the city of Spokane. We've got to, Mr. Lindsay makes a good point about people wanting to do their own wells, but we don't have an unlimited ability to create 10-acre tracts homes in the county on the outskirts of the cities. We at some point have to have infill, we have to have density. I mean, the city of Paris, France could fit inside our borders of Spokane. Spokane is 70 square miles. So the fact that we do urban development outside of Spokane when we have dirt lots in downtown area and the central part of Spokane makes no sense whatsoever. And the only way I can see that we can compel the county to kind of work with us and plan together is to really take control of our water planning and say, hey, we need to be deliberate about when we serve water and where we do it.
But what would be more incentive to like you said, develop these areas that are inside the city that aren't developed right now? I mean, is there a way, tax incentives or something to do this too?
Well, let's put it this way. We could put almost all the incentives you can think of, but if greenfield development outside of our borders is cheaper and they can get cheap water and they can get a permit easily and there's a lower building costs out there, mm-hmm. and in our real estate, we don't list transportation costs as an attribute to a home. So potential buyers don't realize if they move that far out, it's going to cost them a lot more to get around in our city. If we continue doing that, it's really hard to get things into balance and make sure that people do infill. Every time we do that dense development outside of one of our cities, it makes it harder to do the infill inside.
Okay. I want to talk about another threat to our own water supply, and then we'll try to start moving into talking about some of the chemical and other contaminant issues. But there's been talk about bottled water companies like Nestle coming into communities, I believe in Oregon, and trying to buy up water rights there and actually use the water from a prolific aquifer to sell outside their area. I remember that years ago, probably 15 years ago, there was this plan for what was called the Cogentrix plant out in the Rathdrum Prairie that was turned down by the Kootenai County Commissioners. This was a plant that was supposed to use 7 million gallons of water a day. They turned that down. I'm just curious, I mean, do we have any kind of mechanism in place to protect our own Spokane aquifer from a private company coming in and intending to bottle water? I mean, let's start with Guy. I mean, do you know
The Cogentrix matter was actually settled by the Idaho Department of Water Resources.
That's right. I'm sorry. You're correct.
The use of that water was not in the interest of the people of the state of Idaho.
Right.
They found it wasn't a beneficial use. Here in Washington, bottled water is a beneficial use. So at the state level, we would not object. We would very, it's extremely unlikely we'd issue a water right for such a thing in the Spokane Aquifer that wasn't interruptible to the in-stream flow. But if an outfit arrived here and wanted to pump city water and bottle it and send it out, that's a local decision.
John? Can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
So if they came to Rick and said, you know, we want to hook up to city water and then we're going to bottle it, that becomes a utility decision, a city of Spokane decision. But if they're somewhere else in the county, how is it different? And I was particularly interested in, I know we have a number of wells out in the county or outside the city of Spokane that are kind of grandfathered in. They're older wells that aren't, there's no monitoring necessarily of how much is being pulled out of them. And I wonder if one of those could be sold or change hands for a use.
Such a company could move to this area and purchase a water right or go to one of the other 28 purveyors in the valley and get that water and apply it to a beneficial use. The state isn't in the business of deciding what's good and bad. That's local. You get to decide what's good for you and what's not.
Rachel, have you been in communication with any other communities, how they've dealt with that? Or
as Guy said, this system for granting water rights has been around for 100 years, and it'd be 100 years in 2017, actually. And the state has been in the business of saying yes for decades and issued water rights in this basin that, again, it really exceeds supply. And only about half of the water rights that have been granted on paper are actually being utilized right now. The city about half of the city's water rights are not being pumped. And so this is a concern that municipalities that hold water rights are going to grow into these water rights in the future. And when they do so, it is going to take water out of the river. Potentially another couple hundred CFS, cubic feet per second of water, could be coming out of the Spokane River. So decisions by the city whether to sell to a bottled water supplier or to export water out to the West Plains, and we hear the city is reliant upon water sales for revenue, become a decision to further dewater the Spokane River. So we have a management problem in this community, and we're going to have to be making decisions in the future about whether we want a healthy river or whether we want growth at all cost.
And I was asking you, too, are you familiar at all with that case with Nestle? Because I believe it was a community in Oregon where they were trying to buy the rights. I'm just curious if anybody knows how those communities have been dealing with it.
Well, Nestle is all over the country,
right,
buying
sure.
up water rights.
Do you know
rights.
How other communities have dealt with that? Or
Local groups and local communities have fought Nestle, and some places successfully and some places not. Part of it really depends on the political will of the community as to whether they are going to allow that kind of industry to come in and use local water.
Okay.
If it was beer and it had 5,000 jobs for our community, would that be bad? Should the state say no then? I'll bet we have a different conversation today if we did that. So that's a local decision, and it needs to be there.
Does the state of Washington have a comparable agency? I mean, is ecology the same as the Idaho Department of Water Resources, or do we don't have our Washington Department of Water Resources?
Our Washington Department of Water Resources is the Water Resources Program within the Department of Ecology.
Okay. But let's talk about some water quality issues, and let's talk about the aquifer to start with. So, Guy, do you want to talk about, I mean, what kind of monitoring of the aquifer itself can we do right now to look at quality issues, maybe with contamination and the like?
Well, we benefit from years of studies here on the quality of our aquifer. We have an infrastructure of over 50 publicly owned monitoring wells that have been installed by various jurisdictions. We've installed some, the county has, and those can be monitored at any time. The county has, United States Geologic Survey has, most of the water purveyors have. Those can be monitored at any time for water quality and problems if there's a specific issue. Mm-hmm. There's also ambient monitoring that's being done, and Rob Lindsay's group at the county does that. Rob, maybe you'd like to talk about that.
Thank you, Guy. I'm going to take a step back and make the statement that aquifer protection is the foundational concept of the county's wastewater treatment system. In the late 1970s, a group of visionary businessmen in the community started to think about the thousands, the tens of thousands of septic tanks that were being constructed in the Spokane Valley on top of the aquifer. Mm-hmm. And they developed what was called the Spokane County Water Quality Management Plan. Now, granted, I was about 10 years old at the time, so I wasn't too up on the meetings. I do remember, I grew up in Spokane, and I remember the discussions when I was in high school about going back and forth about, you know, the benefits of putting in a sewer or the cost of putting in the sewer, you know, prohibitive costs. Mm-hmm. So, again, the community in the late 70s voted upon themselves an aquifer protection area fee. And that fee was a modest fee that went to all of the citizens in the city of Spokane and the county on the order of $15 a year. That funded the county's sewer program. And so the county then started laying pipe out in the valley, taking all these septic tanks offline. 30,000 have been taken offline in the last 30 years. And so that's the foundation of the county's program. Now, for many years then, the county and the city partnered, and that wastewater from the county and the valley, rather, was then routed to the city's Riverside plant. Now, more recently, the county has constructed their own facility. But mm-hmm. I just wanted to remind everybody that aquifer protection was the foundational idea behind the county's program. Yes, as part of that water quality management program, Spokane County Water Resources Program is conducting an ongoing water quality monitoring program of those many wells that Guy has mentioned. And when the program was started, we were seeing elevated levels of nutrients, particularly along the aquifer margins, primarily as nutrients and then also as chlorides. Over time, through the monitoring, we've seen a marked decrease in those nutrients in the aquifer. And so
that's all related to the sewering, right?
Right, yeah. And the intent of the monitoring was to demonstrate the beneficial effects of the sewering program.
Now, what about other contaminants? I mean, what about questions to do with like the tank farms in the valley or the rail yards or any of this kind of thing?
We remember that in that same time, we've cleaned up, I think, 7 or maybe it's 9 federal national priority list sites over the aquifer here. Mm-hmm. Landfills and industrial sites. All the tank farms today have response plans and monitoring in place. If they have a leak, they have a response plan, they have leak detection. Most of the industrial facilities are monitored on a regular basis. It's a way different scenario now than it was when Rob and I began our careers in this business. It was pretty much Wild West then, and now it's there's hundreds of people employed making sure that our water is safe and clean and available and relatively low cost.
And a follow-up too, Rob. So when we're talking about sewering, I know that up in the Suncrest area, because they're in the UGA, the urban growth area now, they're talking about having to do the sewer up there to protect Long Lake. But you had mentioned this charge that everyone in the county was paying, like, what was it, $15, you said?
Well, within an area defined as an aquifer protection area.
Yeah, well, so what I'm curious, though, for folks up there, what is the financing mechanism to help those type of people pay to getting those places in place? Do you guys know?
In an area such as Suncrest?
Yeah,
well, for starters, exactly. That's in Stevens County.
Okay.
I really can't speak to the public funding process that goes into that. The LID process,
okay.
But it becomes a community discussion, and when it comes to wastewater, it's like, how much are we willing to pay as a community to clean the water? I mean, I made reference to that discussion in the late 70s when the APA was coming in, when the county sewer program was being developed, as I noted. city's now spending on the order of $300 million to address water quality. Okay. And there's going to be more money spent.
We've spent billions since the 70s, probably on the order of $3 billion on the Washington side alone, mm-hmm. in terms of sewering, cleanup of contaminated sites, addressing threats, sewer plant upgrades. There's been a lot done.
And I'm wondering a little bit about the enforcement level, too. I mean, I'm not doubting that you're saying it's adequate, but what comes to mind in my memory, and this obviously isn't even in Washington, but over in Idaho, when the Burlington Northern Refueling Depot went online and they had touted it as being safe, and within a month they had this leak of gasoline that they didn't know about. And I'm just kind of curious, I mean, do we have people in our state that are actually out, not just enforcing, but actually checking these various sites that you're talking about, like the
yes.
tank farms and the like?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
And remember that leak was discovered in a monitoring system installed to discover leaks.
Okay.
So, you know, we've got people doing that.
Actually, that's
folks
not
are
correct.
Working.
Sorry.
Rachel, you wanted to comment?
Sorry. It was discovered when they went to look at the wastewater tank and found that the wastewater pipe had broken.
That's in Idaho.
In the Burlington Northern Refueling. Okay.
Well. Yeah, but we're downstream.
Understood.
Yeah, that's true.
No, I agree, but I think Guy was talking about programs in Washington.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought you were talking about how they found the wastewater leak at the fuel depot.
Okay. John, you wanted to talk a little about, when I had quizzed you before the event, about pollution that was in the river that you wanted to ensure wasn't getting into the well heads, because there'd been a wellhead protection kind of system set up.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry, Steve, I still can't shake Guy's vision of a brewery that employs 5,000 people. That'd be like a beer facility the size of Fairchild Air Force Base. But yeah, well, you know, we have all of our, and Rick can speak to this, I mean, all of our wells are past the, all of our wells are past the recharge area for the river. Isn't that right, Rachel? So at the point where the river is charging the aquifer, we're all downstream from that, all of our wells. So that's, you know, that's a concern. And Rick came to us last year looking at trying to maybe move one of our wells or replace it, because it's very close to not only the airport there out at Feltz Field, but also to the rail line. And the rail line has been a big topic of discussion, moving coal and oil by rail. We have about 19 miles of rail line, I think, in Spokane County that runs right next to bodies of water or in close proximity. And then we also have the rail lines cross the Spokane River, I believe twice in Spokane County, and Latah Creek, which feeds the Spokane River, also twice. So when you think about what could possibly happen there with some sort of catastrophe, our watershed is like one of the prime concerns. After the explosion, or, you know, hopefully not, the next concern, you know, you'd be thinking about is really how this would impact our watershed, and would it get to our wells, would it get to our river, and would it continue to flow downstream?
Okay.
You've just heard the first hour of our two-hour program, Spokane Public Radio Talks, Our Water, Our Future, which was recorded at Spokane's City Council Chambers on September 24th. Our thanks to forum partner City Cable 5 and our panelists. The event donors are National Endowment for the Arts and Sayre, Sayre & Fossum, attorneys at law, emphasizing senior citizen law, disability, long-term care benefits, and estate planning at 325-7330. More information about the forum and a resource list is online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Our thanks to Emmett Steckelberg for post-production editing.